I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And
joining us now is Patricia T. O'Connor, who has written a number of books about the language and who has visited us on a regular basis to talk about language and related matters and take your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And Pat, you are thinking about what's about to happen, the World Cup and soccer. Nobody in the world calls it soccer except Americans.
Well, there's a good reason for that. Actually, the World Cup is going to be starting in a couple of weeks, so we're going to be inundated for the whole month with World Cup, World Cup, World Cup. So we're going to hear the word soccer a lot, at least over here. So I thought I'd talk about the word soccer. It's an interesting word. As you know, it's not really used much for that game in England, but it was developed in England. And here's how it happened. Games involving football have been known in England since the 1400s, early 1400s. And it wasn't until about the 1800s that anyone thought of standardizing the rules in which you have two teams kicking around a ball and trying to get it at one end or the other of a field.
Well, there's another sport, rugby, which has a similar goal.
Exactly. But at the time we're talking about, the mid-19th century, rugby and they were all one. It was all one big game called football. Until finally the Football Association drew up its rules in 1863, and it codified the game. And afterward, there was a differentiation in British sport between what was called association football, that is, football played by the rules of the Football Association, and rugby football, which was a brand of football named after the rugby school in Warwickshire. They had slightly different rules, and the rugby people didn't go along with the association rules, so they split off, and you had basically two kinds of games. So where does soccer come in? As it happens, in the linguistic traditions of late 19th century and early 20th century England, people, especially upper class people in the public schools in the universities of England, they enjoyed using the suffix er to form slang words. They would shorten a word to its stem and then add er. And in the 1880s and 1890s, words evolved like footer for football, rugger for rugby, and soccer for association football.
I thought it came from soccer to me.
Good guess. A very good guess. As such a common phrase in 19th century England. But actually, the word soccer was formed by adding the er suffix to a part of the abbreviation of association, which was ASSOC, so it became known as soccer. But it was always a slang word in Britain. That wasn't the official name of the game. Purists insisted on calling it football, and it's always remained football.
The rest of the world?
In the rest of the world. But the difference is that in North America, in Canada, in the United States, we formed our own sort of football, called more or less American football.
More like rugby.
It's more like rugby, yes. It's rougher and has an elliptical ball, and it involves carrying the ball, not just kicking.
Yeah, in fact, it shouldn't be called football. I think the British have a good case for their sport being called football, and we should call our sport something else.
Like?
Rugger.
Rugger. Yeah, right. But anyway, there's a good reason why we still use the words. We use the slang term for what they play and reserve football for what we play. So to make that differentiation. Otherwise, things would be pretty confusing. But in fact,
But there are international rules now. And
yes.
And it is interesting that this sport has become so popular all over the world. I understand cricket's popularity in former British colonies, but football, soccer, is popular throughout the world in places that weren't British colonies, Brazil being one of the great soccer countries. And yet you have to wonder why this sport has caught on the way it has, to the point where people are obsessed in different parts of the world.
Yes, and, you know, I wasn't really aware of how popular soccer was here.
It's
until
becoming
the
70s, more and more. Yeah.
When the term soccer mom evolved.
But that's because the sport has been so popular with kids. What's really good about soccer is that, at least when it's played by kids, girls and boys can play together.
Right.
The kinds of things that are required for other sports, like size, height for basketball,
right,
and bulk for other sports like baseball and football, don't really apply in soccer. You can be a small person and be a very great soccer player. And I think that that's one of the reasons it became so popular with kids. There are those ASO teams all over America.
Also, it's fun to run around the field.
Yeah. So you have some other – before we take calls, and our number here is 212-433-9692. And a reminder that we're talking about soccer, but you don't have to talk about soccer. You can talk about anything that is language-related that might be interesting to discuss. Our number, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. The popular sound, goal, 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 is associated with soccer. Now, goal is a British word. Or an English word, and yet everybody knows the word goal all around the world.
True. We don't use the term goal in football as much.
Well, we have the goalposts.
We have goalposts, yes, but we don't have...
And in hockey, we have goals.
True.
And in life, I have a few goals. I was always wondering why the word goal is so similar to the English spelling of the word jail.
Yes, well, that's kind of a long story. In England... the word has been spelled J-A-I-L and G-A-O-L both ways. It's just that G-O-A-L has prevailed in British usage and J-A-I-L has prevailed in our usage.
Mm-hmm. So Reading jail, for years I wondered what the heck Oscar Wilde was writing about.
Goal.
I thought, well, that's a strange goal to have, to be thrown into jail. What are some of the other soccer terms that we might be less familiar with?
Well,
that are interesting?
There is one. I mean, it's a rather negative usage, I suppose. But, you know, soccer doesn't need the World Cup to get into the news. It's known for being, unfortunately, sometimes rather violent, and there's a lot of gang violence associated with.
And I've wondered why, the word hooligan has been associated with soccer rather than...
rioters.
Yeah, rioters or...
punks or vandals. Right. Well, there's a reason for that, too. Hooligan, originally in the 1890s, it meant a young street tough, often a member of a gang. So it implies an organized kind of vandalism or thievery or ne'er-do-well doing. The kind of violence that goes on in soccer is, for the most part, not anonymous or spontaneous. There are actually firms, as their gangs are called in British slang, that exist for the sole purpose of attacking fans from the opposing side. They organize this activity. They plan it beforehand. And it doesn't always take place at the match. It might be before, during, or after the match. In fact, sometimes it's planned for some distance from the stadium in order to foil the police, who are always on the lookout for this kind of thing.
Do we have any idea of why this occurs and why we haven't seen something similar between Mets and Yankees fans?
I don't know, but I'm glad we don't.
Well, right now, I'm sure the Yankees fans would beat the Mets fans, considering the way the season is going for the Mets. But it doesn't matter whether your team is a giant success or not. You could be a very successful hooligan group rooting for a losing team.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. In fact, I can see that the hooligans might be a lot more upset by having their teams lose and have the other teams rub it in the, or the other fans rubbing it in their faces. But the term hooligan is one of those linguistic mysteries. We don't know exactly how it originated, but one theory is that there was a name of a name hooligan that appeared in an 1890s British music hall song, and the hooligans were a fictional rowdy Irish family that did a lot of bad things. So,
and then the word hooligan now is used in any country where football, soccer is played.
Yes, yes. In fact, soccer hooliganism has become an established phrase. Unfortunately.
Napoleon on Twitter asks, in cricket we say batsman and fieldsman. Why do American sports say batter and fielder? Because we're smarter than they are?
Well,
I mean,
I don't
is
know.
Batsman better? I don't know.
I don't know. Batter seems more concise.
What about the people who
concise.
Clean the field? Then they become supermen?
It almost seems more of a British usage to say batter and fielder, mm-hmm. since the British are fond of using
ERs.
Bedroom, a slang word for bedroom used to be bedder. Mm. And, of course, there's bedsitter for mm-hmm. bed-sitting room. So it's
so
an old
it doesn't
tradition.
Make any sense.
Yeah.
But nothing does when we talk about language. That's part of the fun of talking about
That's
it, isn't
true.
It?
That's true. It's hard to figure out.
Let's take a call. This is from Joe from Harlem. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
How are you?
We are well, Joe. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I'd like your guest to talk about the origin of the term soccer mom. There's a demographic that's implied in soccer mom, and it's a suburban mother with a van ferrying her soccer-playing children from match to match or from activity to activity, and it's not an urban term. Everywhere mm-hmm. else in the world, soccer is a working-class sport, mm-hmm. but it's not so here.
True.
And I'll hang up and listen if your guest can talk about that at all.
That's true. That's an important point, that it is more of a identified as a working-class sport in European countries and elsewhere, and here it's rather a privileged sport.
And you see kids kicking balls around, practicing their moves on the streets of other countries.
You do.
Here, most of
here
it is
organized
and
yes.
it's in parks, and mm-hmm. that's perhaps a reason. But I was always curious about why there aren't we haven't talked much about soccer dads, because these absolutely obsessed fathers.
Yeah, it's not
fathers.
Like Little League dads. For some reason, it's the Little League dad and the soccer mom, and I think it's because of what the caller said. You have this vision of moms with vans taking turns, picking up all the kids in the neighborhood and whatever, taking them to soccer practice. But it's true that over the years, the whole reason the term soccer mom has survived is that it's become identified with this particular demographic. It's active, involved moms who are considered as a class, for example, of influential voters or consumers or whatever, the demographic that everybody wants to sell to, that you
then
need
we
to
had,
win over.
We have hockey moms as well.
We do. We don't yeah. hear that much about hockey moms, do we?
Well, that's because
or
we're
lacrosse
not in
moms.
There are hockey moms in this area, but you don't hear about them as much because you can play soccer anywhere.
That's
and you
true.
Can only play hockey where there are rinks.
True.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, author of a number of books on the English language, beginning with Woe Is I, which is now very popular with crossword puzzle writers. Words Fail Me, You Send Me, Origin of the Species, Woe Is I Junior, all available at your local bookstore or mm-hmm. on one of those internet book companies. We will continue our conversation. Take your calls, 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Thopate.
What I'd give to hear those three little words.
And we're back with Patricia T. O'Connor and your calls at 212-433-9692. We're talking about soccer and other sports, but also about the language in general, so don't feel limited. And let's go to Jean from Manhattan. Hi, Jean. You're on the air.
Hi,
Joan,
no,
I'm sorry.
Joan, yeah. Hi, you know, I just realized while I was waiting, I had another question that I actually prefer to the one I was going to ask. So I'm going to switch my question, if that's okay.
Of course it's okay.
It's about the phrase...
As long as the FCC approves.
Is it against the rules?
No, go ahead.
I don't want to cause you any fines or anything. You can bill me for the fine. Okay. It's the expression, a bridge too far. Now, there was a movie and a book in the 70s called A Bridge Too Far, and the story of it was the Allies were going behind enemy lines, and they were blowing up Nazi bridges. And they managed to blow up everyone on their list except the last one. That was a bridge too far. Now, I'd never heard that expression before, and I only started hearing it in common usage about 20 years ago as a general expression for, you know, one challenge too many. You know, they might be able to beat that team over there, but that other team, well, that's a bridge too far. Mike Pesca said that once on your station. So what I'm wondering
is... If Mike Pesca said it, it must be true.
It must be true. Okay, what I want to know is which came first. Was it already an expression in use in Britain, and they just took it for the name because it was a cute, concrete pun kind of thing for the name of the movie and the book? Or did people start using it from the movie?
Joan, I think that we don't know the answer. But my guess, and Pat...
My guess is that it followed the movie.
Yeah, the book or the movie.
Yeah.
And that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Now, Joan was going to ask about pulling one's leg. She switched to a bridge too far. Which, of course, took us a bridge too far. But pulling one's leg, I've always been curious about that.
Well, I've never researched that. I don't know what the answer is.
But it
means kidding someone.
Yes. Trying to fool somebody, actually.
Yeah, to fool someone, pull the wool over his eyes, pull his leg. But I don't know why pull the leg.
So, Joan,
I'll have
you're
to do a blog.
For, you're
I'll
0
do a
for
2
here,
item
Joan.
About that, and I'll...
You're 0 for 2. Joan 2, Leonard and Pat nil.
A question too
as
far.
The Brits would say. why do they say nil instead of nothing or zero? We do not say nil.
We do sometimes.
We do.
I hear nil.
In sports context, the Mets are losing 5-0?
No. You mean like as in love? 3-0. You ever had 3-0? No, it's not used here.
Michael from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I have an alternate origin for soccer. It may not be alternate, it may just be antecedent. My understanding was that because the Vikings were so hated during their invasions of Britain that the locals would take the head off a Viking and use it as a ball. Now, I don't think the Vikings found it so amusing, but it's certainly it's an amusing possibility.
It is. It is. Yeah.
And thank God it hasn't extended to Minnesota.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The problem is that the word soccer didn't appear until about 1880,
which
is long after the Vikings. And the etymology that I gave is the one that's given in the Oxford English Dictionary as authoritative. And usually if they don't know for sure, they don't venture it.
Yes. So that's why we don't call it head ball.
Yeah.
Ooh, I like that. And
I think this was all an extended pulling of our leg, don't you?
Pete from Brooklyn, you also think that soccer or football had ancient antecedents?
Hello, yes. I have a firm memory of a vague source, but I do recall...
Oh, but that's always good. You sound like the New York Times.
I do recall reading a bunch of times in different places, maybe in and around Shakespeare, I don't know, but there were complaints, usually from the nobility, about the young lads in the villages playing football, I would imagine with bladders or maybe pieces of skin or something, instead of attending to their archery, which was supposed to be England's strength, but it was deteriorating, and they were worried about you know, we're not ready for the next Agincourt.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I've read about that, too. You're talking about the origin of the word football. I mean, you're not saying that soccer was around in Shakespeare's time.
There may have been a different game.
No, but football has been known since the 1420s as a term, football, in England, in English.
And, you know, Jane Austen used the word baseball.
Yes.
And listeners immediately wrote to me to tell me that rounders precedes baseball, which wasn't the point. The point is that Jane Austen said baseball. She didn't say rounders.
Exactly.
So the football in Shakespeare's time might have been a very different game.
True.
But it may have been some early version.
It may have been similar. It probably involved one ball and two teams of guys, each trying to get it to the other's goals.
And we have some of these sports like that.
Field. Yeah,
we have hockey. That's field hockey is like that before there was ice hockey.
Even basketball is rather like that.
Yes, all the same idea. In fact, that's what American football is as well. So I guess that's a very ancient. In fact, the Mexicans, the Mayans played to the death.
In ancient Greece and Rome and ancient China, there were games involving the kicking around of balls by two different teams of guys.
Aria from West Orange, New Jersey. Hi, you're on there.
Hi there. I just want to bring up this subject, why soccer has never become popular in this country. And I think it's because of television. They cannot stop the clock for commercials.
Well, I think, isn't that a little ex post facto, considering the fact that baseball and football and basketball were already very popular sports in this country, and Americans could have embraced soccer before television would have gotten involved, but didn't. There were people playing soccer in this country, but most of them were immigrants.
Yes. And it's becoming popular, and it's because
you'd think that cricket would be really popular because you could have commercials between every batter.
People who really like and would like to see soccer, television is not going to have a choice. But everything has become so commercialized here that, to me, it basically destroyed the enjoyment of watching American sports. It's all about the commercials, that they have breaks that they didn't have before. They stop for commercials where they get a cue from the sideline from a stage manager when they can continue the game.
Well, that's a problem with commercial
broadcasting.
There's
some commercialism involved in soccer as well. I mean, they have their halftime ceremonies with entertainment. In fact, the term halftime was also a British invention. It was adopted over here for our football games, but it's the same interval.
Well, Aria, of course, is listening to public radio where we don't have commercials, and maybe some brilliant person will come up with a public radio version of sports broadcasting. But here's the problem. The teams all rely on the money they get from the broadcasters. That pays for players. It pays for all sorts of other things. And they would not really like it if those commercials did not exist.
Mm.
So I guess we're just stuck.
Yeah.
Robert from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, always nice to hear you on air, Patricia. The other day I used a very common idiomatic expression, actually writing someone, and I said, I realize I wear my feelings on my sleeve. Mm. And on the spot, I just started riffing to my addressee. Where does such an expression come from, since presumably you show your feelings on your face, you're as transparent as I? Where do we get your sleeve?
I think that's a variation of the old expression about wearing your heart on your sleeve. Mm. And there is a story that developed during the age of chivalry when a knight would dedicate his performance in a tournament to a particular lady, and he would wear a scrap of her fabric or her handkerchief or something on his sleeve into the joust or whatever.
I didn't realize it had such a gallant.
Well, I'm not saying that that's the actual
origin.
That's
true.
I think I've read that, but I'm not saying.
Well, I saw Ivanhoe, the movie with Robert Taylor. And
oh, well, there you go.
Was it Robert Taylor and Elizabeth Taylor? Anyway, I know Elizabeth Taylor played the beautiful Jewess in that. And when he wore, whoever it was, wore her little cloth on his sleeve, everybody mm-hmm. was aghast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, aghast is a wonderful word, but...
It is.
Ken. Hi. Ken from...
From Wilton, Connecticut.
Wilton, Connecticut.
I'm calling about the question about A Bridge Too Far. It comes from originally from a book written by Cornelius Ryan, who was living in Wilton at the time when he wrote that book. He was quoting one of Montgomery's assistants, General Frederick Browning, who, when asked about the plan not to blow up the three bridges but to capture three bridges and cross the Rhine early, said, "I think we might be going a bridge too far." And that, of course, was turned out to be correct. Thousands of British soldiers were killed and captured in that battle.
Mm.
That does make sense, and thank you.
Certainly.
And we go now to Elaine. Elaine from Queens? Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I was wondering if your guest could speak to the derivation of footy as the slang term for Australian rules football. I know earlier you referred to footer in the early annals of football terminology. Does she have any information to share with regard to the advent of the usage for footy?
Footy in Australia?
Well,
I don't know. I'm not familiar with that.
But just like was ER that like footer? Is something that mm-hmm. the Brits do, E is something that you hear from Australians mm-hmm. in some cases.
Now, Australians...
Like, put another Barbie on, whatever that is.
A shrimp on the Barbie. Right. Australians...
They don't say the bobber.
True. Australians and New Zealanders sometimes use the word soccer, as we do here in North America. For the most part, they use the word football.
Claire, hi. You have the reason behind pulling one's leg?
Yes, I do, and I'm actually an Australian as well, and I can say in response to Elaine about footy, we're just reckless abbreviators of everything.
And you add E to a lot of things?
And we add E to anything and everything. You were spot on, Leonard. but yes, in terms of the origins of pulling one's leg, it actually references another part of the male anatomy that's more femur adjacent than tibia adjacent, and it literally means like I'm playing around with you mm-hmm. in the most intimate sense. I'm jerking you around.
Thank yes. you for being so discreet in that explanation, but I understand what you're saying.
Yes.
And I was told that ancient Greeks sometimes greeted each other by doing that. I guess that if you pulled hard, you would have been causing some trouble.
You mean pulled hard on the leg or... No, okay, never mind.
That other leg. We have very little time, but I wanted to slip Bill from Bricktown, New Jersey in here. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you today?
Could you do it very quickly?
Yes, I can. Just wondering why in rugby, when the player scores a point, it's called a try. I would think it should be called a succeed.
You got me there, Bill.
Well, but that is interesting. You know, what it all proves is, and I hope nobody who is British is listening, they are strange people. I mean, I remember when I lived in England and a typical breakfast was drippings on toast. So people who come up with something like drippings on toast can come up with all sorts of things. Do you know why it's called rugby?
I do not.
It's uh-huh. named after the school of rugby.
Yeah, rugby is the school, but it could just as easily have been Eton, couldn't it?
Oh, it could.
A little too rough for Eton.
Winchester.
Okay. Well, Pat, people can reach you
right.
through your website.
Grammarphobia.com.
And they leave questions for you, some
yes.
of which wind up being sources of discussions on this show.
True.
And of course, they have all the books that they also can go to. Lots of ways that you can make contact with Patricia T. O'Connor. Pat, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.